Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Seth David Radwell. He's a successful businessman whose experiences include president of eScholastic and CEO of the Proactive Company. He's also an independent scholar and the author of a relatively new book on politics titled American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. Mr. Radwell, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be here, Grant, and feel free to call me Seth. I'm glad to be here, and I'd love to just chat with you about it.
Well, we're happy that you made the time. Looks like a really interesting and important book. So let me just start with a really basic question. How'd you get the idea to write it when you did?
Yeah, well, my whole career has been in business. I've been a kind of marketing executive, so it is a good question. I think around 2018-19, I became so frustrated with the state of our political discourse and how I felt it was collapsing that I started doing some research. Now, to be fair, I've always been a big reader in the civic sector, nonfiction and history, but I got very involved with a thesis that I started to develop kind of 2019. And what made me do that was, I guess, two things. One was, first of all, I noticed, as I mentioned, that our civic discourse had collapsed. But more concerning to me was that I noticed my fellow peers, CEOs, were increasingly putting their heads in the sand, afraid to engage. And I thought to myself, you know, that's kind of a mess. If both the public sector is not working and private sector leadership won't step up, we don't have a very good chance of bestowing a democratic republic to our kids, do we? And I ended up doing research, which led to the book. And I left my career because I didn't know this at the time, but I got very involved with it. And the book won the International Book Award. And I started speaking a lot starting in like 2023.
Great. Okay. So now it's right there in the title, The Two Enlightenments. I think I know what those are. You obviously know what those are, but a lot of our listeners won't. So briefly tell me, what are the two enlightenments?
Great. Well, I entitled it The Two Enlightenments specifically to be provocative, because people who have some sense of history know what the Enlightenment was usually. But it turns out, since the purpose of the book is to trace the roots of our divisions in America, one of my major findings from the research I did is that, in fact, the divisions we see today are derivative of an original American schism that happened at the founding. Mm-hmm. And that founding was about two competing interpretations of the Enlightenment social contract model and how they should be interpreted. And those two models were vying for prominence. In fact, they were vying so much for prominence and competing that it was that difference between those two Enlightenments that created the Federalists on one hand and the Democratic Republicans on the other, the first political parties. So it was quite divisive at the time. But in fact, unless we understand the divisions between what that split was about, what that original American schism based on two different Enlightenment philosophies, unless we understand that, in my view, it's going to be very hard to heal today.
So what is the core of the difference there then?
Well, yeah, of course, it's fairly complex, but to break it down and make it easy for your listeners, there are two fundamental differences in how our founders, if you will, the creators of our country, experienced and interpreted the Enlightenment. So, of course, the Enlightenment is the period when it covered so many different areas. But one of the major focal points of the Enlightenment was the idea of a social contract, which is, you know, why form a society? What they used to call inalienable rights do people have that needed to be protected that when we form a society, we should do? And so that was the big question. You know, you have to remember, before the Enlightenment, for 2,000 years, your position in life was basically determined by how you were born. And, right, you know, if you had land or not. So this idea of having some form of society based on models. Now, there were models in Greece and in the Venetian Republic and in Rome. So they had some models from history. But the philosophers came up with this new social contract model. So what's the difference? Well, let me characterize the difference by speaking of specific founders so you have a sense. So there was one group, like the best example would be John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. They became the Federalists. And their interpretation, their version of the Enlightenment, was structured around the idea of what used to be called an aristocratic republic. They thought that it was the responsibility of the educated, the well-off, because remember, not everyone was educated in the 18th century. You know, it was the responsibility of the educated on behalf of society to govern and devise solutions and programs that become the social contract. So that was very much, you know, John Adams was a leader in the colonies. Alexander Hamilton was not born an aristocrat, but he was a brilliant genius who kind of became one. And those guys, their model was like what was in England after the British Constitution, which was to control the king by having, you know, aristocrats create rules and guidelines. So that was their model. They eschewed democracy. They were not, in fact, many of the guys in that camp, they were mostly guys, they were afraid of democracy. It meant mob rule, and they was out of hand. And so they were not, that was one model. Now, the other model, which was very different, was really predicated on a different part of the Enlightenment, more the French Enlightenment than the British. And the people who were affected in our country of our founders were Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Paine. Mm-hmm. And they all really were influenced by the French Enlightenment. And for the what I call in the book the Radical Enlightenment, although the radical is probably not the best term, but it was a different framework. For those philosophers, the only sustainable form of republic that could work was one in which citizens elect representatives, what we call a democracy today, to create an egalitarian set of interests. That, you know, in fact, what really is at the crux of what makes the social contract work and sustain is going to be a democratic republic. And so their model was very different. And, you know, when I say that these, you know, of course, there are other differences. There was a big difference regarding the approach to religion, which we can come back to. But to keep it short, those were the two big differences which drove the schism. And you see it very much today, very active, that same division.
Yeah, I want to get into some of the parallels that you're seeing. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Seth David Radwell. He's a businessman and the author of American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. So I'm going to jump around just a little bit, but I'll work my way through it. But one of the things that I wanted to get your thoughts on early is this notion of the populism, which we have been hearing a lot about in recent years, and certainly it was there around the turn of the century, and then it comes again later in the 20th century. But populism, in your rendition, is do I have this right? It's kind of a counter-Enlightenment thinking?
Well, not really. I mean, populism, which is the idea in its base, is the first problem, I should say, is that the way we use the term has evolved.
Right.
So today, populist movements are often, stoked by political operatives trying to curry favor with voters. And that's where the counter-Enlightenment piece comes in. So it's okay. Not that the populist movements of having egalitarian people are in ways are very productive for our society. And I can explain why. The first populist wave was with Andrew Jackson. And it turns out that in the first phase of our republic, the Federalists who we came up with a mixed model that had elements of both of these solutions in it, but it was mostly more of the Federalist model. They were not solving problems to the satisfaction of the citizens. And so it was Jackson as a president who let everyone vote. But when I say everyone vote, if you're a white man with property at that time. So let's be clear. You know, that's one of the whole interesting part of American history is the contradictions. You know, right. We have this credo called the Declaration. And so I won't go there, but what I'll say is populism has been a good force at times. What popularist movements have done is they've expressed the fact that the elites who are in the establishment are not solving problems. They're forgetting about the people. So let me use an example when populism was very important. In the late 19th century, in the 1880s and 90s, farmers across the country were getting killed by big business, by steel, banks, and railroads. And they just couldn't compete. They were really poor. Now, a populist movement bottom up started called the Farmers Alliance. It became the People's Party later. But this movement really helped educate farmers about how to, you know, purchase together in groups, how to take on these big interests. And it was very, it was a movement that was definitely bottom-up populism. And it was searching for political solutions that led to the progressive era, you know, 25 years later. So that's an example where a populist bottom-up movement was very productive. So we have to be careful. This is why it's so confusing, in fact, because when populism becomes a rage vehicle, when it becomes disassociated with problem solving, is where this counter enlightenment set comes in. And that's we've seen a lot of that recently.
The other moment that struck me was how Franklin Roosevelt kind of incorporated some of those populist movements and then channeled them into the New Deal. So I wanted to ask you, my understanding is that you spend part of your life or have spent part of your life in Paris.
Yes.
And I wanted to get your impressions of something based on that experience. Do you think there's anything, because obviously what you're writing about has a lot to do with this notion of American exceptionalism.
Yes.
And I was wondering, do you think there's anything to that notion of American exceptionalism when it comes to our political culture? You're someone who's had a foot in Europe and had a foot in the United States. Is there a there?
Well, you know, that's a great question. So first of all, a lot of the themes of this, what we're talking about, these divisions between these different philosophies fueling incredible strife in our society is not American only. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in most Western societies, and there are a bunch of reasons why. But let me answer your question this way. We are the best, despite all of our flaws and our warts as a country, we're the best example of self-government in the history of the world, in the written history of the world, which is quite something. There are other countries that have done quite well as well, but I think we have the best track record. And it's not because of, yes, we're exceptional. Other countries have other exceptional qualities. So I exceptional is interesting because in certain ways we're exceptional. I think I just came back from France and I think the way they pulled off this Olympics was exceptional. I mean, so we could talk about that. So what's exceptional about America? Well, this is where it's not that we have the biggest military. See, what's exceptional about America is the dream that you can come from nowhere and build a successful, prosperous life. That is the big difference of our historical counterparts in most parts of the world. You know, and for 2,000 years, the world hasn't run that way. So that's exceptional. Reagan was right about that. I hope that answers your question.
It does. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Seth David Bradwell. The businessman has written American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation, and we've been discussing his book. So now I want to kind of fast forward more to the present, given that the historical context that you put forward in the first half there. And first ask you, how are these enlightenments playing out today? What are the tensions? What are the things that you see there?
Sure. Well, that's a very important question. Today, what the split is basically from that elite versus populist war that started that we were talking about prior. But it manifests itself differently in every era. So today, the truth is that for 50 years, we've been following an economic model, which in the trade is called neoliberalism or globalization, whatever, which has been a way of being competitive worldwide. Not only with the leaders, but all Western countries have followed it. Now, the problem is that model, while it lifts average prosperity for everyone, it's left millions of Americans behind. And so there are hundreds of millions of Americans that have been devastated by this model. Mm. And the elites, you know, the elite model, that half, whether it's Democrat or Republican, they have lent a deaf ear to those complaints. So this is where Trump was right, what he was plugging into. Right. I can go on and on, but if you're in a working class American in a rural part of America, you're in the third generation to suffer from globalization. You watched your grandparents lose their job in the steel mill. Your parents tried to make a living by being a contractor in a community that had been very vibrant, but was shrinking. And now the third generation, you see a lot of opioid addiction and it's really devastated. So this is not, this has been going on for quite some time. And the elites, and I put myself in that category, we have not effectively addressed this. Whether it's Mitt Romney's takers or Hillary Clinton's deplorables, we've shown nothing but disdain for this pain and suffering.
Mm. And so how do you see then the two enlightenments as somehow carrying the secret sauce to ameliorate the deep polarization that's affecting our political system right now? I mean, how do you, where is the solution there?
Well, so American Schism, the book, after it diagnoses these forces and how they've changed, it lays out a solution path. And what the solution path really involves is the following. History can act as a salve for our wounds if we'd apply it. So when you look at how these forces played out, it turns out at times it was quite violent, like the Civil War. When these at times we use what I call a secret sauce. We used a combination of elements to allow us, in spite of great division, to move forward. And that's the secret sauce that's missing today. That's what I work to, in my plan in the book and what I work on day in and day out, are two fundamental set of changes. On one hand, it's about mindset changes, like understanding what it means to be in a society with other citizens who are, you know, despite what Newt getting rich started, are not the enemy. We're not all enemies. You know, it's impossible. So that's so the mindset piece is important. But equally, there are terrible incentives today that have developed. So we need structural change to take away these bad incentives. So I work on both of those. So an example would be things like open primaries or ranked choice voting. Those would be structural changes. Mindset changes are groups like Braver Angels who are trying to get people with different opinions to talk to each other in a rational, fact-based way. So when you move into the solution space, the problem today, Grant, is not that our history doesn't show a solution path. It does, but we're not following it. We're increasingly screaming at each other, and we're allowing the extremes, the lunatics, to run the asylum. Mm. And that's not a way to operate.
Yeah, well, one of the organizations that came to my mind when you were talking about that was the Problem Solvers Caucus in Congress, where they're working across lines.
Great example. And they are doing some great work.
And the ranked choice voting and the open primaries, I think, is very intriguing as well. I guess I'm wondering about, though, that's one way to go forward. Another way to go one that one might imagine would be that one of these two enlightenments or one of these two ways of thinking about things kind of wins out over the other. In other words, they don't exist in this in this wonderful kind of tension that advances both of them. Do you have worries about that right now, that we might be facing that possible future?
I think there's no question that these two models are in tension, and what I describe it in the book is like a pendulum. We've swung back and forth between periods when one was more dominant than the other. But the fact is both are vital. In other words, if you want to solve problems, you need expertise. You need surgery, you go to a surgeon. So you need smart people in the spirit of Alexander Hamilton to create solutions in government. But if the solutions aren't addressing the needs of the people, they've got to speak up. So I argue that it's not in spite of, but because we've had these two models in balance, even though it goes out of balance at times, that's the reason why we've been the most successful example of self-government in our history. I have a recent article on this about, you know, why we're a democratic republic, because both aspects are important. So I think they need to be in a healthy tension. I think let's say populist movements are very important for identifying when there are serious problems. Now, if the problem solvers don't listen to them, then we end up like we are today.
Mm. If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Seth David Radwell. And we've been discussing his new book titled American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. So you write about in your book the need to build what you call a just meritocracy.
Right.
And that's a very contentious word, has become one. So what is a just meritocracy for you?
Okay. Well, this goes back a little bit to the vision behind why we're exceptional, the notion that anyone can succeed here with hard work. So in order for the merit, for a meritocratic system means that we distribute rewards in society, not based on some, you know, communistic or Marxian system where it's kind of equal outcomes, but people who do better are those that contribute more in achievements, not in potential, but in achievements. Now, the reason why that's important is because it's what drives innovation and improvement. It's what drives this, why a capitalist model is, if it's properly regulated, which it isn't today, we'll come back to that if we have time, why that model works. Now, what a just meritocracy means is that we've allowed our meritocratic society to get out of whack in a big way. So it's out of whack because there are different starting lines. In order for a meritocracy to work, everybody has to have the same and equal shot at opportunity, at acquiring skills. We need some degree of equality in how in terms of presenting opportunities to people. Now, if you characterize, let's say, the education investment that we make between a kid in private school where the system is spending about $100,000 a year on his or her education, and a kid in public school in an inner city where the number's like 15,000, it's like almost like an eighth of what we're spending, that investment each year is cumulative. So how could you expect, you know, someone from an inner city who's had a poor education, how will they compete? So what the goal of, in my view, of the meritocracy is to figure out how to level the playing field, but still use, I would never argue for going to some kind of equal outcome system. I think we need a capitalist system, but our goal should be to get a fair starting line.
Hmm. Do you think there are implications for our ability to ameliorate the depth of the schism depending on the outcome of this coming election? I know that you probably don't want to be partisan in the book, but you know, is it going to matter who wins in November?
Yes, I think it does. And you know, I am I'm nonpartisan. I've been pretty center most of my life. In fact, that's why I argue the central problem solving is so important. And I think most Americans are left or right of center. In fact, my research shows 70% of Americans are part of that frustrated majority. So I think this election is important because we've had a two-party system, but in this case, on the Republican side, you have a candidate who's thrived on denying truth and on not using the secret sauce, let's say. So in other words, if Liz Cheney was Republican running against, Harris or Biden, I think I would be very happy if either won. So you know, the Republican Party is a problem-solving party up until it's the takeover by Trump. So yes, I believe that Trumpism has been a very dangerous movement, not because it doesn't, A, really respect the norms of democracy, A, but B, it also selectively uses truth to meet its own goals. And that's, I think, very dangerous. So yes, I do think this election matters a lot.
Another way to say what you just said there at the end is to say not only a problem with democracy, but a problem with republic. And thinking thinking about that. So right. We've got about 3 minutes left or so, and I wanted to get your reflections on a final question here. And it kind of comes from what we've just been talking about. But there are commentators that regard this upcoming election. They use the word existential, for example. And there's two ways to hear what you're saying. One is, you know, we've had these divisions in our past and our institutions have risen to the occasion. We as Americans have risen to the occasion. So there's no reason to think we won't be able to do it again. And then there's another way to see this as somehow this rift we're going through now is different from all the others and more dangerous. And therefore, if we don't get it right, we're in danger of losing our republic. Which one is it?
It's the latter. I want to be very clear. It's we are in danger because the other path, the other choice is intentionally breaking norms to move to a new model. That model is the Putin model, an authoritarian system where power gets consolidated and you have an illiberal society. So yes, look, the tricky part of your question and why this is confusing is because we have a lot of changes to do and push for regardless of who wins. But it's clear to me that one side is moving further away from the solution space than in a big way than the other. So this this juncture is extremely important. And I think that, it's very important that we embrace the values and the norms and not that we've been successful at fostering. And that's why this election is unusual. We have a secret sauce. We've moved away from it in the last couple of cycles, but now we're about to take a huge step away from it maybe again. And we got to move back into the solution space where we use empirical data, where we respect each other's opinion, where we incorporate compromise into solutions, all the things that the current political system deny us.
And we've only got about a minute, but just to push you a little bit further on that. So you mentioned Liz Cheney before, and you'd be happy with seeing her running. Is this a problem with a person, or is this a problem with a party?
Very often in history, different people have risen to what's been called a cult, where they take over a movement. And we've seen this repeatedly throughout history. And I think that's what happened here. There was tremendous suffering going on in the country because of this rejection of, but because of neoliberalism and not dealing with all these problems we talked about. So there was pent up suffering, and that's been used to create this movement of, it's really anti-democratic, I think. Mm. And it's very dangerous.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it on that happy note, but that was Seth David Radwell. And again, his new book is American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. And what I think makes it very interesting is he goes back in time and really does tell an interesting story about two important currents in fundamental American thinking, but then brings it right up to the present and thinks about how this could help us figure out a way to get out of the problems that we're in. So, Mr. Rabel, congratulations on writing the book. It's a very clever way to do that, and nicely done.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being with you, and I'd love to come back sometime.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.